outside the Pythian millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian. How are you this evening?
Very well, thanks. And do you believe that that there is an intention on the part of this Tea Party caucus and the leadership in the House to continue this shutdown of the government? One clue might be what Congressman Ryan just said today, that we have a debt limit. I'm quoting him. We have a debt limit coming. Most budget agreements in the past have always involved debt limit increases. We think that's a forcing mechanism. And then he goes on to say that that's what we need, a forcing action to bring the two parties together. We don't want to close the government down, but we want to open, and we want fairness, and we want a budget agreement that gets the debt under control. So there you have it, I think, don't you, that we're heading they're going to use these next 2 weeks to leverage the next crisis. So what's your sense?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we're in for a very difficult period. I have for some time anticipated that this would come this week. And I'm actually one of those people who thinks that they might take us over the cliff on the debt ceiling and that we could go into a period of 2, 3, 4 weeks where we're operating in an environment that is extra legal in some sense, that in effect the government will try to contain its costs by simply continuing this furloughing, expanding the furloughing, starting to cut a variety of services, there would be a nervous market reaction. I'm not one who thinks that Armageddon will come immediately, but there will be a growing apprehension. I mean, I think that the governments of our major trading partners understand that we're in the midst of a political crisis, and for a whole lot of reasons, including the recovery of their own economies, will not take precipitous action. But I think that there will be a reaction from the markets, and I think that the markets will pull back from terror. They'll initially be frightened. They'll pull back. They'll then see whether there's a political agreement. If there's no political agreement, the markets will dip further. It'll go step by step in terms of market reaction. But I do think that we very well could go over this debt ceiling cliff.
So if we do, Richard Parker, go over the cliff on the debt ceiling, would it precipitate a recession similar to what happened in 1937, where in the midst of the Depression, you had a downturn because of the recovery was throttled. And, you know, it's pretty clear that that is a Republican strategy to throttle this recovery. That's been clear from day one.
I don't think it would be as severe as 1937 because I don't think that this Depression that has been materially as severe for most Americans is the Great Depression. But we could have something very severe.
And how long could this? You're saying that it won't necessarily be Armageddon, but how long before? Hello. Unfortunately, you're dropping out on us. The call's dropping out. So. Okay, we'll have to call him right back. I'm sorry. I believe he's at a hockey game for his son. So normally we like to get people on landlines, but sometimes it can't be done. So let's hope that we can get Richard Parker back here momentarily. Again, he teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. I hope we can talk a little longer here, and that you're in a better spot on the hockey field. Yep. There.
We're out of the hockey rink. We're on the way home. I just went through a tunnel at the Tobit Bridge. That may have been in there.
Oh, that's what happened. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So just walk us through the possible scenario that we've agreed that this shutdown of the government may only be the beginning of a strategy that will go on for a couple of weeks until the October 17th deadline on raising the debt limit. And through that period, as Congressman Ryan has said, they want to use the debt limit increase as a forcing mechanism, which is a polite way of extortion. So walk us through if we do go over the cliff and what it's going to do in terms of setting back the economy.
Well, in effect, what's going to happen is that the Treasury cannot issue more Treasury bills to place on the market because it will have exceeded its limits in terms of issuance of total debt. Outstanding, you can't issue new debt, that is new bonds, and get money out of the markets in order to meet the cash needs of the federal government, to pay Social Security, to do all sorts of other things. Now, what you do then is the federal government has to drastically cut back its expenditures to try to manage as best it can within the available cash flowing in through its tax revenues, through Social Security payments, through income tax, et cetera, et cetera. But this is going to be very difficult, and the markets know that it's going to be very difficult. And so what will happen is that bond prices will start to rise, interest rates on bonds will start to rise, because the perceived risk of holding U.S. Treasury bonds will suddenly become much greater. How, you know, what will happen? What will we do? Now, huge institutional holders, that is foreign governments and institutions, have incredibly long time horizons and would be willing to buy bonds in the secondary market at those higher prices, but that doesn't necessarily put new cash in the hands of the federal government, because this is trading in the secondary markets. And so what you'll see is the bond interest rates will rise precipitously. The markets will start to show signs of trouble in other bond markets. The flow of cash that's been coming into the United States, because we've been seen as a safe haven and as a place where when the rest of the world is going crazy, you can always carefully park your money in the U.S., will be eroded. And what's going to happen then is even when we get a settlement of this, and we will get some kind of settlement, you're going to have created a new climate of perception around U.S. market securities, U.S. government securities, which means that the cost of borrowing for the federal government is likely to rise on an average basis to place higher than it would have been, meaning that the effective ability of the government to borrow at a cheap rate is going to be significantly reduced. And that's going to have long-term structural impacts on the federal government and on the American economy, because when treasuries are no longer trusted, then all markets for financial instruments related to the United States and then indirectly to much of the rest of the world are going to become perceived as shaky. And that's not a good environment when you're trying to come out of a global recession.
And the Treasury is still the gold standard in the world economy,
Absolutely.
So Richard Parker, the previous guest John Dean was suggesting that the Tea Party people survive and thrive because their constituents are what he referred to as low information voters, and that they maybe will go through a learning curve if things get bad for them. But at this point, they're just as riled up as their representatives are. Do you have any? At the risk of indulging in cheap psychiatrics, do you have any idea about their motivations? Is there a method to their madness? Go ahead.
I think several things. I think sometimes all of us, when we think that our opponents are behaving irrationally, ought to think of what I call local rationality. members of Congress are elected by their congressional district. Senators are elected by their state. I just had lunch with Al Franken this weekend, and he was saying, you know, how powerful it is to be a senator of the United States, but you're a senator from Minnesota. And so when he worries about reaching compromises with the Republicans, he has to think about Minnesota business, Minnesota industry, Minnesota farmers, as well as the good interests of the United States. And that local rationality is what's driving this. I mean, I think that when we get into a place where we start to yell about the irrationality of our opponents and we treat it as some new novel crisis, we're forgetting our own history. America has been clouded since the beginning with these kinds of showdowns that have occurred. We had a showdown in the 1830s. We had a horrific showdown in the 1860s called the Civil War. We had a showdown in the 1890s around the populist upsurge of William Jennings Bryan. We had another one in 1932. We had another one in 1970, and that led into the Reagan election. This is a very divided country. I remind students when I teach them that the phrase the United States of America was employed in the plural up to the Civil War. It's only after the Civil War that we began to talk about the United States as a singular. And, you know, to bind this country together where there are so many groups separated geographically, religiously, ethnically, and around core ideas, people vote in large measure as an affirmation of identity and community and an affirmation of the values of their community. And it's the minority of voters, in truth, who actually are able to see national interests in ways that are, in fact, effectively able to lead politicians toward compromise. Now, we talk about some kind of golden age in the recent past where politicians could get work done, as if the 50s and 60s and even 70s were great times. But you have to remember that the dark shadow of communism was hanging over that entire period, and it bludgeoned a lot of otherwise dissenting views into conformity that were necessarily going to disappear in terms of their conformity once the perceived threat of a Soviet empire was removed from the world stage. And we're now in a period where there is no single guiding external threat. Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalism are by no means of the same scale or the same magnitude as a state-to-state threat that was represented in the Soviet-American struggle of the 1940s through the up to the 1990s. And there's a kind of way in which the parts of the American vehicle start to shake loose when there isn't that single road that drives us for us all to drive down. And I think that we're in actually a period of an era change. We had a long era that ran from the end of the Second World War right up to Richard Nixon that was broadly governed, whether or not we agree in detail, broadly governed by the principles of the New Deal. And from Jimmy Carter up to Barack Obama, we had a long conservative period governed by, you know, in essence, the values represented by Ronald Reagan. Now, the fact of the matter is that Ronald Reagan's era didn't deliver on its promise. Its promise was balanced budgets and smaller government. Then Ronald Reagan delivered the largest governments, the largest deficits prior to this 2008 meltdown of the post-war period. And so there's an incredible frustration among those local communities that adhere to Reagan-esque conservative principles, who adhere to them actually even in the long Roosevelt period, but about which they were pragmatic for a few years because their economic suffering was so great. They're now bound to these principles in a way that means that it's very difficult to shake them loose in those local reasoning systems from their beliefs. They see the external world as a threat, and they mean to challenge it wherever they can. And that's how you get these members of Congress, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, willing to take us over a cliff. They have not been lifted out of their local rationality and their local experience in a way that makes them think that there are national consequences from their local behavior yet. And they see instead a narrative of the nation going awry that is an absolute threat to the continued existence of their local rationality and their local existence. And they're fighting like mad because of that narrative in their own imagination.
But Richard Parker, can't we add to this that picture of minority government, which is what we have now, a government by extortion? We have a minority through gerrymandering in the House, and that these people are all being funded, particularly like the Ted Cruz's and others, are being funded by the Koch brothers and by the Club for Growth, which is funded in turn by plutocrats. So isn't that a situation where a handful of plutocrats are pushing the government further and further to the right?
Well, you know, it's true, everything that you said, but it's also true that this has been characteristic of America in earlier periods, 1890s. The multimillionaires of the 1890s, who were lined up by Mark Hanna, who was the Karl Rove of the Republican Party a century, 130 years ago, was not at all unlike what we're seeing today. The Liberty Lobby in the 1930s, the same sort of thing. The role of Texas oil millionaires like H.L. Hunt in the 1950s and spreading their extremism in the John Birch Society. Very similar today. We have to assume not that this is some new upswelling that America has no experience with, but that we have had to fight these kinds of battles in which plutocrats have stepped forward to finance and encourage extreme right-wing activity that has been characteristic of the Republic from the late 19th century forward. And that doesn't make it easier, that doesn't make it less dangerous, but it means that we have been in this kind of battle before, and it ought to encourage people to realize that these forces can be turned back, because they have been. Not permanently, that's the whole point, they keep recurring, but they can be turned back. And I do think that we have a moment here where this economy is going to take a beating as a consequence of this Republican Party, Tea Party recklessness, that I think actually could begin to create a new political era that looks more democratic beginning 3 to 5 years from now. But we're by no means there yet.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Delightful to talk with you as always, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was the co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the launch of the Affordable Care Act with a former insurance company insider.